You know, I think
we should submit to them. Well, members, we don't have a quorum, but we'll get started here. We'll invite Mansco Perry up, the executive director of State Board of Investments, and to come up and start giving his overview. And when we get a quorum, we'll take up the minutes and then at some point do the bill that's on the agenda. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is, my name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. I believe you've got some handouts. And the first thing I'll do is go over the sheet that's labeled at a glance to give you kind of an overview of what the organization is and what we spend most of our time doing. The State Board of Investment created by the Constitution, and the members are the governor, the state auditor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. We're assisted significantly by a 17-member investment advisory council. The makeup of the council are the three statewide pension directors, the commissioner of management and budget. The governor appoints two active members of the pension plans and one retiree, but we have 10 members of the public who are very instrumental in what we do. They, by statute, they have to have a background in finance and investments. We're fortunate to have some of the chief investment officers from some major Fortune 500, a couple of the colleges, and some of our larger foundations in the state who are working with us. I'm appointed by the board and have the responsibility for running day-to-day operations and hiring a staff who does the bulk of that work for us. At the end of the fiscal year, we had about $97 billion that we were responsible for. I'd say that given what's happened since that time, we're probably somewhere in the range of $93, $94 billion still. We essentially have several investment programs. The one that people are most familiar with are the combined pension plans. That's where the assets of the Teachers Retirement Association, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and the Minnesota State Employees System, that's where their assets reside. They're about 70% of what we manage. We also manage what we call participant-directed investments. Those are the deferred comp plan, the assets in the unclassified retirement plan, the 529 plan, and a plan called ABLE, which is Achieve a Better Life. Those are assets that we oversee for people who have disabilities. Additionally, we have a non-retirement program, which basically consists of stock and bonds, but they fund the permanent school fund, the environmental trust fund, other local city and county entities, and a variety of other smaller agencies who have the authority to invest with us. And we also manage the state cash accounts, which include the funds and general funds, but also all of the cash that's used for operations by all the state agencies. If you turn to the handout, get to our the overview, the handout that we've got there. As I said before, we probably are in have assets under management now of approximately $95 billion. And, you know, we most of our operations, we oversee outside managers. We have about 40 stock and bond managers that were responsible for making recommendations that we hire them, and we monitor and evaluate them on a daily basis. We also have about almost 100 private market managers who we also invest much of our assets with. If you turn to page 4, you'll see our budget. We're allocated $139,000 as part of the biennial budget process from the legislature. Most of our funding comes from dedicated receipts. We have budget on the order of $6 million to run our operations. That's generally funded by the initially funded by the pension funds, but then we charge back to any of the organizations that we're managing assets for. We also have a statutory appropriation of about $5 million, which are primarily used to pay for the investment consultants that work with us on a regular basis. If you turn the next page, our budget process is pretty simple. Every fiscal year, I have to put together a management and budget plan, which is reviewed by the administrative committee of the state board, and ultimately has to be approved by the members of the State Board of Investment. With regards to what we do, we have here we've got kind of a highlight of the amount of revenues that we've been generated. We generate from most of our programs the investment earnings and the distributions that are made to the organizations that we manage money for. Over the last five fiscal years, we've seen an increase of almost $30 billion in pension fund assets, and it's about $6 billion a year. We distribute on a monthly basis somewhat an order of $200 million net. That's net of the contributions that come in. So we're sending out about $2 billion a year from the fund to assist in the payment of pension benefits. With regards to our non-retirement assets, we've generated on the order of about $110 million a year in each of the last five fiscal years. And we generate on the order of $75 to $100 million of cash. It's been a low interest rate environment that goes to the general fund and to the owners of the state cash accounts. Currently, I have a staff of about 22 people. A little more than half of those are people who have investment expertise and help manage the fund, and the residual make up our accounting and administrative staff. The investment staff is compensated according to salary plan that has been in existence for about a dozen years or so, and it's provided by statute. As I said before, our main responsibilities are to manage the outside managers. Our activities include monitoring their performance, ensuring that they comply with our guidelines, and then reporting to the our Investment Advisory Council, the board, and several other entities. We manage money internally only for the state cash accounts. We work with M&B to ensure that we know what the flows are going to be on a daily basis. In addition to that, we have a program where we buy certificates of deposits of community banks around the state, and that's been a program that's been in place for about the last three decades. So some of our administrative responsibilities, we have a couple of custodial banks. That's where the assets actually reside. That's how our public market managers are access our account. And so those are pretty instrumental bodies for us, but so most of the assets are there and safely in custody. We develop internal controls to ensure the validity of the information that we're reporting with regards to the assets that we hold. But for the most part, in addition to managing the managers, we spend a fair amount of time just ensuring that we are transparent where we can be with regards to the assets under our care and under the management of our external managers. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for the director? Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you had said that the balance was probably around 93 to 94 billion. That's based off of some activity at the end of the year, or what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kwok. The approximate 93 billion is made up of the assets of about as of the end of January, about 67 billion of those are for the pension plans. There are 10 to 12 billion that make up the state account, the state cash accounts. Approximately 10 or so billion that are in the deferred compensation and defined defined contribution retirement plans that we manage for individuals, and then the residual would be in the non-retirement accounts that we have.
Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, September 30th to now, a drop of 4%. I didn't know if there were some things that were, that's why I was after, is trying to, you know, that is not an inconsequential, and I thought, well, maybe things happen at the end of the year to where, you know, there's that kind of adjustment.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Kwok. So in the fourth quarter was very bad quarter in the equity markets, and I think we were down about 4 or 5% as of the end of January, or last week, last time I looked at numbers. The combined funds, which is what the main focus is, we were back in positive territory for the fiscal year. It's a few basis points above zero, but still positive.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kwok.
I understand that ebb and flow, and I also understand that from when the quoted date here to now, it that point to this point in equities is fairly flat. You know, that all the major indices are basically approximately that level. You know, much less than a 4% change, and I was curious if, you know, if you have a 4% change from then, was there an activity, because it appears to be somewhat outside of, you know, just saying equity here, equity there, is there a reason why it's a 3 to 4 billion dollar decrease? I mean, this, you know, it's a non-trivial amount, so that's why it popped to my attention.
Mr. Manskell.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative, so the 90-plus billion that I reference includes all. So I don't have all the details, but that would also include the full flows in the state cash accounts. Not certain where we stood at that into January, but the best estimates are that you know, we were we probably are a little bit down from where we were at the end of the quarter, given the activities of the state.
Mr. Perry, how are we doing toward the benchmarks that we keep? Do we have indexes that we have benchmarks that we use as benchmarks? Are we aligned with those, or below those, or above those?
Mr. Chairman, yes. For the combined funds, I'm happy to say that for all of our reporting periods through December, that for the quarter, we did outperform the composite benchmark by about 10 basis points. And for the remaining reporting periods of a year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and 30 years, we have been above the benchmark on a composite basis. We also measure how we have done over longer periods of time by evaluating the risks that we've taken in the portfolio and equating that to a similarly risked portfolio if we just passively manage stocks and bonds. And relative to that, we have over the last 30 years been about 150 basis points above that. More recently, it's been a little bit better, but the key point there is the it points out that the risk that we've taken in the portfolio has resulted in accretive returns.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Perry. My question is just to clarify one of the slides. It is titled Funds Allocated for the Biennial Budget Process, but then it goes on, in particular, the statutory appropriation of $5 million. Is that an annual appropriation, or is that a biennial appropriation?
Mr. Perry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heumann, that is an annual amount. You'll notice in the numbers there we do have the authority to spend up at the $5 million a year for our investment consultants. We also, in that number, is the authority to hire a private market consultants, given the size of the program we have. You'll notice that if you look at the actual numbers, that we've actually spent less. We've only had the two investment consultants in our employ. We have yet to pull the trigger on the private markets consultants, and that will happen based on some other initiatives that we have going. But that is annual, and those assets are paid directly out of the fund. I've been pretty frugal in the expenditures we've made to run the office and the tenure that I've been back. I think I've returned in excess of $1 million each year for our budget, and haven't spent the full amount of the statutory appropriation.
Representative Hertaus.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, follow up to that explanation. So that is just strictly for consultants. That doesn't include any of the staff personnel that you mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, that's the statutory appropriation is excludes staff and internal operations.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of compliments. First of all, just managing a portfolio like this, I've had the opportunity to manage a really small one, and I know that you look like a hero sometimes and other times you don't. And not many people pay attention, and they don't pay as much attention when you look like a hero as when you don't. So I appreciate your efforts, because it's not an easy place to be there. And secondly, that the bank CD program, being a part of the community banking network, I can tell you how good that is, because it brings a lot of liquidity out, especially into rural Minnesota, and it gives small banks a inroad to getting funds that they wouldn't normally have. So, great program, and thank you for administering that. Question is, you know, we heard last week, and we know that the rate of return is statutorily set on the pensions. And, you know, I know the it's always the risk-reward thing. When we set that as 7.5, which is probably, from my perspective, maybe a little bit above where we should be long-term, does that challenge you more than I shouldn't say does it challenge you more, it does challenge you more, but does it affect your investment philosophy and portfolio makeup, and maybe have you deviate sometimes a little from where you would relative to the risk that you're willing to tolerate?
Mr. Perry.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Vogel, I think with the pension plan, I'm one who's on record stating that what we expect return should be divorced from the rates that the actuaries use. The 7.5 that we've got is down from the 8.5 longer term that we've had. During the discussions of that rate, my personal opinion is that that 7.5 is appropriate, there continues to be discussion as to whether or not we could make more, we can make less. My bigger concern is that we set it last year at 7.5, and my recommendations to Senator Rosen and Representative O'Driscoll is we set it, we stop talking about it, and we come back and look at it 5 years. We're supposed to be long-term investors, and I've noted since 2010 that we have had continual annual discussions about the rate. It went from 8.5 to something called the select and ultimate, where it got jiggered there. Then two of the plans moved it to 8. Now it's down to 7.5. During that time period, our returns, you know, while all over the board, but over the last 5 years, the pension has earned an average annual return of 9.5%. I keep numbers back to about 1981. Since that time, we've had returns of 9.9%. The forecast that we get from consultants and others, you know, we pay much attention to them. Equities are expected to earn a little bit above the 7.5. The big issue in the room is that we're in a low interest rate environment, and you know, we take that seriously. We have about 20% allocated to bonds. I always try to explain to people that bonds are a necessary part of a portfolio, but I don't look at them as being our return generators. They're primarily there to provide a little safety and protection in the event that we do have disappointing equity performance. It will provide some. We split our bond portfolio into a core bond portfolio and a treasury bond portfolio. The treasury bond portfolio, we incepted last year. One of the primary reasons for that is to ensure that we have adequate liquidity, both to pay benefits in that event, but also to enable us to rebalance back to our strategic allocation, which is the primary focus of what we do. We set, we go through an asset liability and asset allocation process, and set what the asset mix should be over long periods of time. That served us well. Back in 08, 09, when the markets did drop, we were able to rebalance back and participated in the upturn that took place after that. So with regards to risk, the big focus is our strategic asset allocation, which we review, well, we review annually, but we go through that process about every 5 years to set that. And the point there is to try to have a long-term outlook. One of the pieces of the portfolio that we've been exceptionally proud about is our private markets portfolio. A lot of people consider them to be risky. Risk from an investment standpoint is really the volatility. We've had less volatility in our private markets. Now, admittedly, some of that's controlled by the managers, but they're not subject to the mark-to-market whims that we have in the stock market, where you can open up in the morning at 100, watch it go up or down 5%, retreat by noon, go the other way by 2 o'clock, and by close be back where you are. And, you know, from my educational background, we learned that stock prices reflect all the information available in a stock at any point in time. I know we're in a very enhanced age of technology. I'm just not convinced that information can flow that fast, that the prices that we see are as accurate as they could be. I'd say much of the volatility we get is due to people's needs for volatility. Only about 2 or 3% of the market trades every day, and those 2 or 3% that are trading, they set the prices of stocks. I guess the other 97 who just tend to hold on, I guess maybe we don't know what we're doing. But so I'd like, I look at and say, we try to be pretty prudent. We set our strategic asset allocation, and we think our results have been decent. And we've had a lot of luck.
Representative Vogel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure most...
It was a long answer, yes.
Yeah, most of the committee has probably heard more than they want to hear about this. And, you know, we may have a conversation offline sometime on the portfolio mix. But thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Perry, Representative Vogel has oftentimes in this committee referred to a term called nerdy, and I guess that's kind of where I'm at. I've taken an interest in this subject with my own participation over the last 17 years, but I have to divorce myself from managing millions as opposed to billions. And obviously, the recovery rate when you have a large asset or a large base can be substantially greater than what you have has a small base that you have to recover from once you've kind of been kicked down to your knees. So that said, could you kind of explain a little bit of the conundrum that I seem to identify and have concern over, and that is with regard to your statement about your keeping records as to annual returns and that you've basically outperformed that 7.5% for a long period of time. If that's the case, if the funds have been consistently exceeding expectations, even that 9.5 is above the 8.5, how is it that we then find ourselves faced with the reality that overall our pension funds managed by the state are anywhere from $19 to $30 billion of unfunded liabilities for the long term? What kind of explanation can you offer me some extra information about what doesn't seem to shore up when returns are consistently greater than the actuarial expectation? Mm-hmm. And it seems like when we have adjusted that expectation down, we seem to, you know, just by virtue of making those changes, decrease our unfunded liability in having done so.
Okay.
Director Perry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertz, I won't profess to be the pension administration expert, but with regards to the conundrum we've had, a lot of it is associated primarily with the Great Recession. As recently as, I think, 2004, all the pension plans were overfunded, actually. The returns that we had in 2008, 2009, the funds dropped about 13%, which is was pretty devastating, and that's what caused a lot of the need back, I think, in 2010. I wasn't here again at that time, but caused a lot of the need for the reform there. While we've had pretty good returns in the last 10 years, we have had some years where they've been low. So the last 5 years, we had 10.3, 15.1, negative 0.1, 4.4, 18.6, and the several years before that, they were double digit. We do have concerns when we have negative returns because money's going out, nothing's coming in. But one of the reasons that we keep trying to get everyone to focus, not really a year-to-year proposition. The pension plans are in place to last over the long term. It still will take us some time to get back. One of the impacts of lowering the discount rate on the liabilities is that the lower the rate, the more the math shows that is owed. And that's a primary reason for the increased unfunded report of where the pension funds are. So if we were to lower the rate again, all else being the same, it would show that there was a greater unfunded liability. So like I said, I'm not the pension guy. You might want to talk to the actuarial guy. You might want to talk to Mr. Anderson about that. But I've always given kind of the simple anecdote that I ask people, how many of you here own a house? How many of you have a mortgage? And how many of you have an unfunded liability, and do you think you're not going to make it? The unfunded liability is just a function that not all the pensions are due today, but we look at the liabilities out into the future.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you. I kind of anticipated that would be the answer, but I was thinking that maybe I'd find a nugget there. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, I don't see any here. Thank you for coming, and thanks for the information.
Okay, thank you.
And now we have a quorum member, so I'll officially call this meeting to order. And Representative Lippert, did you get a chance to read the minutes?
I have. I move that the minutes be approved.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes of February 6, 2019. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. And Representative Purish Kadeem. Is she? Oh, yeah. That's what I thought I saw her coming earlier. I said it right. For a second, I thought he said your name backwards.
Happens.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll move House File 13 be in front of us to be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And members, the parts of this bill that affect us is the funding piece of it. On that, we can ask questions, but we should concentrate on the funding piece of this and not have a relitigation of the other hearing that we had on the content. But I'll allow some leeway there. So,
sure.
Representative Kadeem, you can start your presentation and welcome to the committee. And make sure when you speak, you introduce yourself and testifier. Thank you. My brain's still on 35E driving in this morning. Identify yourself for the tape when you speak.
Anyway. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Kunish Podin, and I'm here today to present some information about House File 13. And with me, I have Kathleen Murphy, who is the Vice President of Minnesota ERA. So I'm here today to present to you the cost of adding a constitutional amendment to our Minnesota Constitution. House File 13 proposes a constitutional amendment to add language to the Minnesota Bill of Rights, specifically Article 1, Section 18, to provide that equality under law shall not be abridged or denied on account of gender. While constitutional amendments are not usual on our ballots, there is a small cost that incurs for the Secretary of State to add that to the ballot. There's a little bit of tweaking the ballot itself in print, and then there's some of the behind-the-scenes activity that goes on the night of an election for the electronic calculations and that sort of thing, and then pushing that information out to the counties and on the website. And according to the fiscal note from the Secretary of State, that cost would be $2,000.
Okay, thank you. And members, you'll see we have a fiscal note with us here, and it was in your packet. And as it happened in the past when we've had, at least in my memory, when we've had constitutional amendments, that the Secretary of State says that they'll absorb the cost of those. But any questions, members? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I didn't get it, my own fault, I didn't get a chance to look at the fiscal note before, but just curious, you know, I think the Secretary of State is going to be requesting a rather large increase possibly in their funding, and I realize $2,000 isn't much, but wondering, you know, how much we can continue to have agencies absorb when apparently they're already underfunded because they're looking for more money. And I didn't know if somebody was from here from the office. I just want to respond and make sure that although it's only $2,000, if other things are coming along, that they really have the ability to continue to absorb cost when indeed they must be underfunded already because they're requesting more money.
I don't see anybody here. I don't know. Anybody here in the committee? Ms. Roberts is. Any history on? Am I correct in saying that they normally absorb these costs? Or,
Mr. Chair, members, yes. As long as I've been here, the Secretary of State's office has absorbed this cost. And I'll just note that their base funding from the general fund is $6.7 million per year.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just bring it up because, you know, it's easy to see. We've had discussions on this the other day with some agencies absorbing cost, and when they've been appearing here, there's been discussion as far as needing more money, and want to make sure that if indeed there's a fiscal note and the responsibility of that bill is financial, that the bill somehow is being supported by funding rather that we consciously decide rather than agencies coming in and asking for more money and then not really totally disclosing it, maybe as it should be. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, members, I would ask for a roll call vote.
A roll call being requested. We will have a roll call vote. Any more questions, members? Looks like you're getting off early this morning, or easy this morning.
Excuse me.
Representative Claiborne.
Yes, I would just like to say, in looking at the literature that Ms. Murphy has put forward in support of this bill, I would just like to know, do you find that this bill is important for both men and women?
Yes, I do.
Please identify yourself.
Sorry. Kathleen Murphy, Vice President of ERA Minnesota.
And
Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, if you would please indulge me just a little bit more. When we speak about children and advocacy for children, that's always been a primary interest for me. Could you please explain to me how this would help fathers in advocating for their parental rights as well?
Well,
it's Murphy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne. The case in point on the literature refers to a Supreme Court case in 2001 where father's rights were not
as equal as women, as the mother's rights, because the child was born outside of this country, because the father was a U.S. citizen, but the mother was not. The father actually had to prove that he would care for that child for the duration of the child's life, which was presumed if it had been a mother.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from this line of questioning, I was wondering if the father's rights would then, with this constitutional amendment, be equivalent in the concerns of an unborn child?
Ms. Murphy.
I'm personally not a lawyer, so I can't speak directly to that.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was surprised because you could speak to other similar issues when questioned, but you have no opinion on this.
Mr. Chair, may
Representative Claiborne.
Yeah. In speaking to the question that I asked before, that was an established piece of case law where there was a verdict entered by the court. Is that correct?
Yes, that went all the way to the Supreme Court, yes.
Thank
Representative
you.
Claiborne.
Well, I'm just interested in keeping children with their parents in the United States if they're U.S. citizens. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just concerned that both parents have equal say in the unborn.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author of the bill, I will apologize. I won't be voting for this bill today because I heard some things this morning, and I haven't had a chance to check them out. And one of them is that there's another state that did this, and then they used the equal rights with the gender language to further taxpayer-funded abortions, which I am against. And I'm wondering, have you heard anything like that? Because I need to get that checked out before I can support this bill.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think that we all know that we can take a piece of legislation and we can use it to our own advantage to support or disqualify another person's viewpoints or agenda. So if other states have done that, then, or if other groups have done that, then that's certainly their prerogative. But the impetus behind this bill has nothing to do with any of those pieces of legislation or lawsuits. This is simply a constitutional amendment recognizing that equal means equal, and it will bolster both the opportunity for men and women to have the opportunity to litigate against unequal pay, unequal treatment, all sorts of things. So any of those sort of agendas outside of simply adding a constitutional amendment that says equality under law shall not be abridged or denied due to the account of gender, that's what this bill is all about and nothing more.
Representative Green.
Well, I appreciate that explanation, but I think we need to look at maybe what unintended consequences might be. And I was looking through our current law, and it looks like we have those protections there now, so I do have to do a little more studying on this.
Thank you, Representative Green. Any further comments, questions? Remember, members, we're here. I saw Hewitt, but remember, we're here to discuss the financial piece of this more so than anything else, the cost of putting this on the ballot. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, how many states have passed this bill since 1972?
Ms. Murphy?
For a state equal rights amendment, there's been 24 states that have an equal rights amendment in their state constitutions.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, and both red and blue states, right? This
yes.
is pretty equal across the board?
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Murphy. Remember to go through the chair, please.
Yes.
Representative Claiborne, I saw you had.
Yeah, redirecting us back to the financial and fiscal note, please. I just want to make sure that I was understanding that before, the Secretary of State has always absorbed the cost of the constitutional amendments that we've had on our ballot before.
Representative Claiborne, that's my understanding, and I understand it's not so much a monetary cost of having to pay money out, but more of a, they call an opportunity cost. They have to have somebody program the machines to tally that, and it's time that they spend in their office. So that's why they normally don't ask for more money when they have to do this.
Thank you very much.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as the representative's question was answered, I had received a clarification from staff that actually only one other state has this verbiage, not 24, and that being Rhode Island. And if you want, we can get into discussion of what the exact verbiage is, but I think everybody here realizes what the difference is.
If I can address that, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, there's varying languages to each state constitutional amendment, which I could provide if you'd like.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, trusting the information I received from staff, nonpartisan staff, the answer to what others, how many states have done this language that we have, and that's one.
I stand correct. Mr. Chair, I stand corrected then.
Ms. Murphy. Members, any more questions, concerns, comments? If not, we'll go to a vote. And a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
All right. Roll call vote on HF 13. Chair Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Akam.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hertas?
No.
Representative Hewitt?
Yes.
Representative Claiborne?
Yes.
Representative Lippert?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
There being nine yeses and four noes, the bill is approved. And it'd be the motion is approved to send it to judiciary. Yeah, I had up my sheet here and then from there to go to civil law. Thank you. Thanks for coming. And
thank you. Thank you.
And now we have an overview from the Pension Commission. Ms. Lincheski. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape. And also remember the question that was asked about the Representative Hertas about why the pension plans and that. Maybe think when we get done that, maybe you can answer that question better than Mr. Perry can.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Susan Lincheski. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. To my left is Chad Burkett. He is our new analyst in the Commission staff office. If you are all right with this, we will kind of take turns giving our presentation. I want to just mention, though, that we were originally scheduled for last week after the pension plan presentation. So the focus for us, consistent with that, is talking about the relationship of the commission to the pension plan. So we're going to kind of give a very brief overview of the commission, but then talk a little bit more about how the commission interacts with the plan directors. So I'll pass to Chad the overview of the commission.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Again, Chad Burkett, analyst for the LCPR. And I'm just going to give a little background information here, and I'll be brief. The commission was established in 1960 to be bipartisan and bicameral and provide consideration of legislation for both houses. specifically for state public pension plans and also other retirement issues. The commission receives proposed legislation from the House Government Operations Committee, so and then the equivalent committee in the Senate, and then considers that legislation, usually puts that together into an omnibus bill, which then goes back to those committees and makes its way through the legislative process. The commission consists of 14 legislators, seven from the House, seven from the Senate. It's typically made up of five from the majority and five from, and two from the minority from each House. Currently, the commission for the current biennium, they've not yet been appointed from the Senate. We actually have all of the members from the House appointed. Three, I think, are on this committee, so Representatives Freiberg and Vogel and Chair Nelson. And then the commission, so the staff of the commission was myself and Ms. Lincheski, and then we have...
Can you speak more into the mic?
Sure.
We're having...
So myself and Ms. Lincheski, and then we have an assistant, Lisa Dieslin, up in G55. We make up the full-time staff for the commission, and we do things... How's that? Okay. So we draft bills. We provide meeting support and meeting materials for commission meetings, and we prepare background policy and background and analysis for bills and any retirement topic that a legislator has a question about. And then we have an actuary that we contract with through Deloitte. They provide some overview of the plan's actuary work. And then we have a website that I would encourage you to visit if you have any questions about the exciting world of public pensions.
Thank you. So I'll describe just a little bit about how the commission works with the plan, the pension plans and the plan directors. An analogy I think is useful is in the private sector for a pension plan or 401k plan, the board of directors will amend the plan, and they are responsible for the plan document. In this case, with the public pension plans, actually the board of trustees or the board of directors for each of the funds has very little responsibility as far as actually amending the plan document. So that responsibility rests with the legislature, and the commission then hears those issues and makes recommendations as to law changes. So the plan documents are all in the statutes, and the legislature is responsible for those. The plan directors, though, working with their boards, they do review the plan document, the statutes. They will come in on an almost annual basis and make suggestions for changes to the plan document. So the statutes then will need to be amended. And so the commission works, and commission staff, we work closely with the plan directors to understand the changes that they feel are necessary and then get them into bill form and then introduced and then moved to the commission where they are reviewed by the commission, and then the commission does take, of course, testimony, including from the directors. In addition, the commission is charged with monitoring the financial status of the plans. So as Chad mentioned, we have an actuary that we will have testify to the commission with respect to the annual actuarial valuations that the plans do, as well as the periodic experience studies, which test the assumptions against the reality or the experience of the plans. So the commission will hear that information. It does receive the reports, so the annual valuation reports, as well as the experience studies, review those reports, take testimony, and then you know, react to that if there's a need for some funding change or something to that effect. In addition, and one of the things that seems to get the most airplay is the actuarial assumptions. So the commission reviews those, gets input from the plan's actuaries as well as their own actuary, Deloitte, and then establishes the assumptions. The commission will review those, make recommendations. The only assumption that is currently in statute is the investment rate of return, the 7.5% that we've been talking about. In addition, the commission will approve the other assumptions, but those are in an appendix to the actuarial standards. which is still underway in process. We moved a bunch of assumptions into another document so that can be more easily changed as experience studies dictate the changes. In addition, and this is apart from the pension plans that you heard about last week, in addition, the commission has oversight of the nearly 650 volunteer firefighter relief association plans, which are little defined benefit plans all across the state. There are a couple of statutes that get amended on a regular basis to try to address issues as they come up with the relief association pension plans. I also, in your in the handout here, I did list the plans. So if there's any question about what we're talking about here, we are talking about the Minnesota State Retirement System, which has five pension plans and a defined contribution plan. PARUP, the Public Employees Retirement Association, has four pension plans, as well as a volunteer firefighter plan that has about 160 fire departments in it. These are formerly relief associations that have joined the statewide plan. So these are little groups that are now benefiting under this more centralized administration over at PARA. PARA also has a defined contribution plan that it administers. Then we have Teachers Retirement Association has the one pension plan. The State Teachers, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association also has a pension plan. And then, as I mentioned, we have the, 610, as I listed here, Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association plans. So that's kind of an overview of the commission as well as its work in connection with our pension plans.
Well, thank you. And you talked about assumptions, and I've been on the pension commission before. What other type of assumptions besides the rate of return do you have that we do on the pension plans that can affect them?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. In addition, we have assumptions for payroll growth, salary increases. Those previously had been in the statute, but as of the 2018 pension bill, they were moved out into an appendix. In addition, mortality. So that's a big factor for the plans that does have a very direct impact on funded status. So mortality is one of the more important assumptions in addition to the other two I mentioned. And then also others such as, the rate of retirement, when people retire, rate of disability, those types of assumptions as well are approved by the commission.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Green leaned over and said, this has got to be the height of nerdom. You got to love it. But I am curious, we talk a lot about the rate of return. How do other states handle this? Because it sounds as not everybody sets it in statute.
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Nelson, Representative Vogel, that is true. I don't have any specific data on that, but we could certainly provide that to you. Often, in many other states, it is not set in statute. So they rely on the Board of Trustees or Board of Directors of the plans to take the advice of those plan actuaries and set the investment rate of return assumption that way. It's a little more than in tune to the changes, I think, of how investments are doing and that sort of thing. But even there, changes are infrequent. In the private sector, they seldom change at all, but in the private sector, in the public sector, there's more frequent change, but they're not embedded in the statute like we are in many states.
Representative Ola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other thing, if you could just talk a little bit, and I know we've talked about the way the state's bond rating, the credit rating, is and how it's affected by the pensions, because depending on that rate of return, this could be a bigger liability, of course, than all of the bonded things, all the GOs that we put out there, and how the rating agencies, my sense is that over the last few years, they've become more likely to challenge or at least look at how we're looking at the pension unfunded liability, not just us, but all states, because it's becoming such a huge issue. Any comments or explanations that you could give us that kind of give us a feel about that, because it probably is as big a part or maybe a bigger part of our bond rating than the actual debt that we're incurring by signing our name on the line for GOs.
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Nelson, Representative Vogel, this is a complicated topic. My understanding, and we could bring in other experts and perhaps one in the audience, in fact, but the bond ratings, I understand, do a lot of their own assessment of the funded status of our plans. They will rely more on the financial statements rather than the actuarial reports. They will bring their own assessment to bear of what they think is a reasonable rate of return. My understanding is that they sort of do a stress test where they will test it at a lower rate and a higher rate than what is currently set in statutes and reach their conclusions about how the plans are funded. GASB does drive some different assumptions, so GASB requires a different way of looking at the investment rate of return, and there has been some press in the last couple of years on what GASB has been telling the credit rating agencies about Minnesota's public pension funds because of the need for a different investment rate of return under the, it's the Government Accounting Standards Board standards for financial statements. Is that helpful?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank
you. Ms. Lucheski, I'm glad you said what GASB was, because I was going to, for the committee, have you tell you what those letters stand for. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was just for the committee's sake, too, because I know not everybody gets off on this stuff like I do, but it really is important, and I truly appreciate what they're doing, because a lot of times, you know, we wait and the rating comes out, and by then it's too late. And with the work that they're doing and the plan managers are doing and so forth, it really has a lot to do with how solvent we're going to be as a state. So really appreciate what you guys do. Thank you.
And Representative Vogel, they changed GASB rules a while back where they all local municipalities had to put their liabilities on their bottom line, and it caused a lot of gnashing of teeth around the state when, you know, City of Brooklyn Park all of a sudden has to say, well, I got this liability that wasn't there last year, and now it's here, and it was because of changes in GASB rules. So more people are being aware of that, of the, that underfunded liability. Any more questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was the GASB 34. I was a city council member in Bloomington at the time, but I just wanted to say that I always appreciate Representative Vogel's perspectives. I'm glad he's a member of this committee because you ask really good questions.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you for the presentation, and we'll be hearing more from you, I suppose, in the future, and hopefully markets stay good.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes. And members, because of the weather and the wonderful driving conditions, I'm going to excuse any members that weren't able to make it in this morning. So, and with that, members, if there's nothing else before the committee, we're adjourned.